Good evening. Today is the 12th of September 2012 and I'm here to interview Monique Garber. Good evening. Monique, can I ask you about your very early days? Could you tell me, please, what your name was at birth, where you were born?
Yes, the name and of birth when? Was Moishe. And I was born in the town of Wolozhin. That's how it's spelled.
Wolozin. And that, I see from your papers, is in Belarus.
It is now in Belarus. Yes.
What was it then?
Poland.
Poland. And tell me a little, if you would, about what life was like then. You were born in, I think you told me, on the 12th of the...
10th of the
10th. 10th of the 12th, 1923.
What was life like? Well, it was still depression. I remember that my uncle in particular was affected because he had sawmill problems selling the goods. Apart from that, I suppose we were thought of as the rich family in the town. But of course, the people assumed that somebody is rich. It wasn't all that easy.
Is that because you were one of the few Jewish families there?
Yes, my grandmother was the last Yitzhakin. Now the Yitzhakins are the people who have founded the yeshiva and the synagogue for that matter too. Some ancestor of mine, also called Chaim Volozhiner, of course, in 1740 he built the synagogue. He was a linen merchant, and linen is bleached in the sun. Mm-hmm. So he had a huge piece of land of several acres on which the sheets of linen are bleached. And somewhere near the bottom of his land, he erected the first synagogue in our town. Now his grandson is known as Etz Chaim. He was a student with the Gaon of Vilna, and the Gaon then encouraged him to start the yeshiva. The money seems to still have been available at then, because he more or less did it largely on his own, plus, believe it or not, the help of the local lord, Kortishkevich, as he sort of supplied materials and things like this. And the rabbinical students are supported for a few years by Chaim Yitzhakin.
And so was this yeshiva still going strong when you were a young boy?
Oh, yes. Strong, I'm not so sure, but I would say there were probably about 40 would-be rabbis. Yeah. At the height of its success, I think they had about nearly 500. It was a huge institution.
It must have been. But yeah. Were your family itself, was your father a part of the yeshiva, or was he just
yeshiva
a businessman?
Was built just opposite the synagogue, sort of, just outside what I think were the original grounds of our family. There were all kinds of problems. The Tsarist government interfered and so on and so on. And of course there are usual problems within the community, different views on things and things like this.
Mm. And was your father part of running the yeshiva or...?
No.
No.
By the time we came along, we merely attended the synagogue, although we were usually seated on the right side of the...
Is that the more honourable side?
Yeah, the honourable side immediately next.
How big was the synagogue at that time?
Very large. It's a very big building, in mm-hmm. fact, yeah.
And the Jewish population
and
of your
Jewish
town?
The Jewish population, about 4,000.
I see.
So,
it wasn't the only synagogue. By then, there was another synagogue at the bottom of the town. And my cousin was telling me there was a third synagogue. Not quite sure that he's right or wrong. My cousin died just 2 years ago in Israel.
Right. And if there were 4,000 Jewish people, what proportion of the town was that? Was that a significant proportion
about
of the town?
80%, I would say.
Gosh. Oh, the majority of the town was Jewish?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realise that. No. And
that was quite common in Poland.
Yes.
In what they called the shtetls.
Right. And if you had such an eminent yeshiva, that would attract other people to come and live there as well.
At that point. Mm.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
My older brother, 6 years older, his name was Daniel Garba, and he was a pianist.
See. So your life must have been fairly lacking in incident till the Nazis rose to power.
Well, more or less, yeah. Well, till the war started.
Till the war started.
And then
what?
I was arrested, not entirely without cause in the eyes of the Soviet Union. And that was in March of 1940, if I'm not mistaken. Was supposed to be held elections for the people to agree to become part of the Soviet Union. And there were various... The school started very quickly after the Russians arrived. School was started. There was a placard with a cut-out head of Stalin and some slogans. Well, whoever glued it on to the paper didn't do too good a job, so his nose was a stuck one. And I sort of... Either my sense of tidiness or whatever it was, partly sort of...
Did you know it was Stalin? You knew what you were doing?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So what did you do with the poster?
Well, I sort of tore off his nose.
And did somebody see you?
Yeah, well, one of the things that Soviet Union immediately organizes is people who report to the authorities. So somebody in the school saw me doing it. I didn't hide it particularly. I didn't think it was very important. And I was arrested. And I was given 5 years in a youth camp after a long train journey and various things. I came to the youth camp and the camp commandant there refused to have me because I was political.
Really?
So, back from Moscow, from the Ukraine, back to Moscow, and then I was sent to an adult concentration camp.
And that was a concentration camp
rather than a youth camp.
But it was not for Jewish people in particular?
No.
No. Just
not specifically for Jewish people.
What happened with your... Did your parents try to get you back? Or because they must have been...
You don't do anything of that kind.
And did they know where you had ended up?
No, I don't think they had the slightest idea where I was. But sometimes in 1941, before I was released, in fact, I received a parcel from my father and my brother. And it's a letter, honey and things like this in it. And I would make a guess that by that time my father was already shot by the time it arrived to me. Because he was, when I was very young, my father was on one occasion, was older man in the town. He was elected older man.
Which is really like a mayor of the town?
Well, sort of. Things have changed. The way local authorities were administered altered in the meantime. But I remember a conversation with my mother in which she more or less was asking why he doesn't want to be an older man again. And he says, because I don't want to be like... And he mentioned the previous elder man. He says, he was an alcoholic, of course, a complete alcoholic, was actually. Everybody wanted to meet the older man, stand a drink and stuff like that. This was a kind of...
It's a way of avoiding getting too much.
To avoid the alcohol, he decided not to be older man. When the Germans came in, they made him head of the Judenrat. And then, of course, he was supposed to choose the usual thing, 50 people to go and do some work, dig trenches. It's basically intended for the graves of the people.
And do you think your father knew that?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
My father was a rather impatient man. He apparently said to the officer, you want to do the dirty job, do it yourself. So the man took out a pistol and shot him. So my father was, in fact, the first man to be shot in our town by the Germans.
And your brother?
My brother was taken from our town to Minsk, which is the nearest large city, almost the nearest Vilna and Minsk. And he was teaching the piano in the conservatory. Mm. He was actually a very proficient pianist.
And what happened to him after that?
After that, he survived the war. He married a Soviet woman. They escaped from the Germans eastwards. And after the war, he thought he could go back to Minsk, to his position as a professor, I suppose, but they wouldn't let him go back, partly because by that time his brother was a traitor to the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. So he must have survived because he wasn't in Poland, he was in
Russia.
He
survived because he was in fact in Kazakhstan, as far as I can make out.
Right. And while that was happening, what happened to you? You were taken to the camp.
Well, I was sent to the first camp, which is not far from the Finnish border. There are two big lakes there, Onega and Ladoga. Ladoga is the northern one, has a long projection northwards, and I was right at the tip there, basically felling trees. And not that I was skilled enough to fell the trees, but I cut the branches and things like that.
So it was a work camp?
It's a work camp, yes.
And were the conditions like the ones you read about in the gulags?
No, the conditions were not the same as in Germany. The population was not intended to be eradicated, but the population was intended to work till they dropped. So basically, people would survive. Some people who sort of knew their way about and were lucky. Camps are administered internally. The prisoners also administer the camp. The guards were outside the actual perimeter, they merely guarded us. Mm. They were a poor lot. They had good food, but apart from that, they were frozen otherwise.
Yeah, they wouldn't have wanted to be there either, I suppose.
Yeah, they kept an eye.
And you were saying that some people survive longer than others under that sort of regime?
Scurvy was one of the worst problems. Frostbite too, but scurvy, for which there was no medical assistance, because scurvy is the last, as far as I know, the lack of vitamin C. And there was nothing to deal with vitamin C. Also, there was cod liver oil to deal with other illnesses.
And what age were you at that?
Well, by then I was 16, 17.
So your education would have stopped?
The time I was in the camps. Now, the reason I was released. I was released in August, September, I think. About September 1941. Now, what has happened? The Germans invaded the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union sought alliance with Britain. They couldn't get an alliance with Britain because they were at war with Poland. Poland was already an ally. So, I don't know how many people know it, but anyway, Stalin was out of action. He had a kind of nervous breakdown after the invasion by Hitler. So the country was administered by Kaganovich and Molotov.
And how
Kaganovich
do you know this?
Was the senior one. How do I know that?
Yes.
Well, amongst other things, at one point we were marshalled in the yard of the camp, and a letter was read out to us about the treacherous Germans having invaded our country and so on and so on. And then it was signed by Kaganovich and Molotov. And everybody in the camp was delighted because that meant that Stalin kicked the bucket. He thought, but he didn't. Kaganovich was the commissar for heavy industry. And he was sort of in charge. Not Molotov. Kaganovich was the top man. What happened to him later, by the time I left the Soviet Union, I couldn't tell you, but he was an elderly man, I think, by then. So.
And what was the consequence of the letter? Were you then released?
Yes, a large number of Poles was released. Stalin then came more or less back into power and stopped the Poles getting out of the Soviet Union. But by that time, I was out.
So you were very fortunate then.
And so you'd said that your father was the first person to have been killed.
Yeah.
What happened to your mother?
Oh, my mother died when I was a 9-year-old boy.
Ah, right, sorry.
And the rest of your town, what happened to them, the 80%?
I would say 95% were probably executed. Mm-hmm. In two actions. I don't remember the details, actually. My cousin was particularly interested in this. It's not just himself, there were several people took part in it. But, some people did survive from our town, you know. Various things, there's sort of a story of two girls found themselves in a village and a peasant sort of said, right, you are my two daughters, you are staying with us. Mm-hmm. So there were various people. There were people who abused the Jews and there were people who helped them. An interesting instance was a man in our town, a Pole. Ah, here I must explain. There were basically three major groups in the town. Jews, Poles, and in today you would call them Belarusians.
Mm-hmm.
But the term Belarus actually was almost invented by Stalin. He created Belarus. There was no such entity ever before historically. And still isn't for my opinion. A Pole married a Jewish woman. The Jews ignored him. The Poles ignored them, and they brought up a family. Now, I'm told again by my cousin, probably he got the information, that when the Jewish people were gathered in a ghetto in the town in several houses, they were the only ones who dared to try and supply food, trying to get through the back where the German guards didn't see them and tried to bring in food and so on.
So they were outside the ghetto? And
Oh, yes.
Because...
You see, he didn't think of her as being Jewish.
Right.
Nobody mentioned it, so
she
survived with her husband.
Yeah. But she still tried to help the Jews
yes,
who were in the ghetto?
Yes, which I thought indicates the fact that there are some human beings.
Who are very decent. No, absolutely. So taking us back to the speech of Kaganovich and your chance to get away, how did you get out of
Well, when I got away, I was told to go, I was direct. In the Soviet Union, people didn't choose where they went. They were told where to go. I was told that I'm to go into the Ural Mountains, a town called Medvedegorsk, copper mines. Well, I didn't fancy the idea. So on the way, I sort of realized help from various other people, at least that Polish army was forming. So I just ran down and I was too young to be a soldier, so I was a cadet.
And they were pleased to have you. Did they know you were Jewish?
Mm-hmm.
They were pleased to have you.
Yeah.
And they knew you were Jewish, but that wasn't a problem.
How does one describe it in Poland? Formally, Poland was a democracy with equal rights for everybody, formally. Was there anti-Semitism? Naturally. But on a formal basis, it was basically, shouldn't I have the right to be there? It wasn't a question of whether they accepted me. You know, I was entitled to be there because I was Polish by nationality.
This is the Polish army after they had been conquered by Germany, is
and
it not?
Russia.
And Russia.
Yeah, because don't forget that 2 weeks after the Germans invaded, the Russian army moved into eastern Poland in huge numbers. And this is what basically collapsed Poland. There might have been longer resistance to the Germans. People get the impression that Poland is completely squashed. It was partly squashed. There are various pockets of resistance. In Gdańsk, the Polish garrison resisted for 2 months.
Mm.
And they were actually killed to a man.
I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
So you were in the Polish army in 1941 in a conquered country.
Yeah.
That's right. And you were still fighting at that point then?
No, there was nobody to fight.
Exactly. You, so that's what I'm trying to do. Yeah. I'm wondering what you're doing there.
We become allies of the Soviet Union.
Right.
Theoretically. But we were allowed to be evacuated. Ah. So after several months in the Soviet Union, by a pretty roundabout route, because to go to the bottom of the Ural Mountains, where the first camp was, we then moved to Tashkent, which is in sort of virtually the center of Central Asia. Then we were taken to a port on the Caspian Sea called Krasnovodsk. From there we sailed to a port in Persia, which at that time the port was named after the Shah of Persia. It's called Pahlavi, which was his family name. And I've looked recently at the map, it's no longer called Pahlavi. But it was a port city on the Caspian. From there we were taken to virtually a suburb of Tehran, because I was in the city on a few occasions. And then we were taken by convoy, this time by Sikh drivers in the British Army, to what is today Iraq. And from there, by some other drivers, into Palestine. Then we were taken by Jewish lorry drivers to an area there where I was sort of enlisted into the army properly. And I was, there are certain things apply in the army, the Polish army. If you become a cavalryman, you have to be a certain height. And I was tall enough to be a cavalryman. So,
had you ever been on a horse?
Only about a couple of times in my life before.
But no problem.
Yeah. I've never been on a horse in the army. But we were sort of then taken to Suez. We accompanied on a French boat called the Mauritania, huge French liner. We took Italian prisoners from Egypt to Durban in South Africa. Then South Africa for a couple of months, basically probably to just feed us up, because most of us were skeletal. And then we took German prisoners who were unsafe to be kept in South Africa, because they used to get out and disappear among the Boer population. So we took them from there. We sailed from Durban past Africa onto the Atlantic, hugged the South American coast, and then eventually developed them in Nova Scotia, in Halifax.
Why were you sent to Nova Scotia?
That they saw that Canada was probably a good place for German.
They're suddenly out of the way there, I suppose. And they were left there in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Yeah, the Germans were left in Halifax. And we joined a convoy. By that time, of course, the United States already, a huge convoy, by convoy we got into Gurok, of all places.
It's a small world, certainly. Yeah. You must have been somewhat confused during all this.
Not
were
really.
You not?
Get in your stride.
You were very young. Yeah. And were you learning English as you went along?
I was sort of... Yes, I was adopted. There was a unit of the British Army called the Cameroons. They were the people who pushed the Italians out of Abyssinia. And a sergeant amongst their lot, for some reason, took a fancy to me and talked in English, taught me some English. But I had to learn English once I arrived here. Mm-hmm. I had a few phrases, but, you know, I could speak to people, but I didn't really have much English.
So when your Polish brigade or whatever it was arrived in Gurok, what happened to them then?
Well, we were properly in the army. We joined what was known as a reconnaissance regiment. And then
but you were still a Polish regiment?
Yeah, in Dalkeith near Edinburgh. That's where I was stationed. There is a big parkland and somebody's mansion in the parkland. That was sort of where our camp was. Then it was decided that armoured cars were not really very useful. Reconnaissance started to be done by aeroplanes, so they didn't need reconnaissance regiments. So it was simply transferred to tanks and landed into Normandy.
So you landed in Normandy as part of the D-Day landings?
Well, no, about, let's say about 5 days later.
Right. And was that still...
heavy tanks, it was not... couldn't be landed right away.
Right, but that was still as part of a Polish
component. That was still part of the Polish army, yes.
Right.
It was one of the three regiments of the 21st Army Group, which was Canadian. The other two regiments were Canadian, and the Polish regiment was known as the 21st Army Group. And that was the group that went right along the coast, and all the way along the French coast eventually into Belgium and Holland.
And you were still fighting then?
Yeah, it was a bit of fighting, yes.
Right. And were you still in Holland when the war ended? What?
No, I was in Germany when the war ended. We, in 1944, we were held up on the estuary of the Rhine, which for some reason, incidentally, in Holland is called the Ems. The Rhine changes its name and it gets into Holland. So we were on the Ems in Holland. And then in 1945, we sort of crossed. In the meantime, there was, of course, the defeat of the paratroopers who tried to cross the estuary. And then there was an attack by the Germans in the eastern Belgium. But in 1945, we crossed. And eventually... we were stationed near south of Bremen, you know where the port of Bremen happened, just south of there.
And that's when the war ended?
That's the war ended, yeah.
How did you feel as a Jewish person going into Germany at that point?
I didn't feel anything, to tell you the truth. We didn't have a clear picture of what was happening. Would I have acted differently? I don't know. Probably not. When you are in the army, you do things with more or less which you have to be done, which you are told to do. Then, in 1945, just about 2 months, 3 months after the war, the Polish government sent me to Oxford. So I was called into the commanding officer's office and was told to pack my kit bag and off to England.
To go to Oxford University?
Mm. Now,
why you?
This is a letter from my commanding officer, who was the colonel when we were the armored cars, sort of. But he was an elderly man, he was retired. So this is a letter from him. My dear boy, with great pleasure and satisfaction, you have given me great pleasure and satisfaction with your letter in which you thank me for helping me to get your education. I'm quite sure that it was not so much my doing, but your willingness and ambition. I have to admit to you that I have of late thought quite a bit about the bitter pills that you must have swallowed whilst you were in the army. And then he changes. Before the war, in Warsaw, I had a great friend of mine who was Jewish. He was one of the most intelligent and learned man that I've ever met in my life. This is why I want it in the archives. I have just now had information from France that the Germans got a hold of him and he was tortured and then killed. I feel that Poland has lost a great intellect in the loss of this man. Poland has lost. And then he tells me about, if you are in Edinburgh, come and see me. And so on.
And he was involved, was he, in ensuring that you went to Oxford, this gentleman?
Now, I was sent to Oxford, and I have never actually, until I found this, I never quite knew why it was that I was chosen. Mind you, I wasn't the only one. 30 of us were sent to Oxford.
Right.
From the Polish army. Yeah. I was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a possibility he may have had more influence than I have thought about it, and maybe he was responsible for it. I have actually forgotten that I've written to him, you know, the whole thing. But anyway, the reason for having this faculty in Oxford was the fact that the Germans have systematically killed all educated people in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in fact an intention to replace the Polish diplomatic corps. So had things gone otherwise, I would have been a Polish diplomat instead of living here. But things didn't go that way, because after my second year, but during my second year,
the when Polish you were, well, sorry to interrupt you, what were you studying when you started studying there?
Law, politics, law and politics.
Which must have been a huge jump, because you had stopped your education all those years before, and then suddenly you're
Oxford.
In Oxford.
Yes. Now, if you ask me how I learned my English, so I said to myself, I'll have to learn English, not just to talk to people. So I got a hold of The Tale of Two Cities and started reading through it with great difficulty.
I think most English speakers find it difficult as well.
Yeah, and since I had to do philosophy, amongst other things, at Oxford, I then went on to something that is difficult, and that is Moore's. He's a professor of philosophy. He is a logician, and it is so difficult to read that most people haven't got through it. But I have read Adventure of Ideas by Moore, which is probably more than most people have ever attended.
Sure.
But anyway, it is. I have acquired my English.
Indeed. In a variety of while you were studying. Mm-hmm. And then what happened then?
The faculty had to dissolve, because the money, Poland had a lot of money. The gold from the Bank of Poland was deposited in Britain. It was rescued from Poland. And then it had to be handed over to the new communist government in Poland. By agreement.
But that meant they couldn't
Britain
pay
retained rent. A certain amount of money for the upkeep of the Polish army, but the rest was transferred. So we simply ran out of money and under the end of it. So I worked. I did a variety of things. Poorly paid, and worked in Peebles and textiles for a while. And at one stage I looked at my demob money, £70. And I said, if I don't get out of here and get a good job, I won't have enough money for a bus ticket.
Oh dear. So how did you do it with your £70?
I found out that they were digging tunnels for the hydroelectric schemes. And that was 1948 or 1949. And I joined the hydroelectric scheme.
Was this you back in Scotland then?
Yeah, I was back in Scotland from London, from Peebles. I went from Peebles to the hydroelectric scheme, the one on Loch Lomond side. Mm-hmm. If you go along Loch Lomond, you can actually see the pipes going down from it, still there. And we were earning big money for those days, £20 a week.
And was that actually a physical job you were doing there?
Oh, yeah,
then?
Very much a physical job. Right. Drilling rock.
And you had no training apart from your wood chopping, had you?
It doesn't require much training, actually. It is not a...
Not particularly skilled?
It's not highly skilled, yeah. It is miserable and wet and damp, and a lot of mud pouring on you. I then went to London, enrolled at London University, sat an entrance exam and got through. And then I realized that my 1,000 and something pounds is not going to stretch, take a degree. So then I got a job in Bradford, again in textiles, which wasn't very much. Then I got a promotion. I got a job in Kilmarnock as a, you know what a dyer is? It's mm-hmm. a textile chemist, I kind mm-hmm. of. So I did this, and I then met my wife, and I got married. And 2 years later, my wife decided that she will work, and I'll go back to university. So I this time went to Glasgow to do an ordinary degree in chemistry, which, because I was a dyer, I thought I could do that. And one of the professors, a certain Dr. Bell, came up to me one day and said, I noticed you're doing an ordinary degree, Mr. Agar. I said, yes. He says, no, that won't do. I said, oh my God, I think I should give it up. So he said, no, I think you should do honours. So that was, so I did honours, and I then did an MSc, and that was it. And after a few years of teaching here in Scotland, I got an offer to teach nuclear physics in Vancouver. So we went there.
And where were you teaching in Scotland?
Round about Glasgow area.
Was that in schools or...?
In schools. Well, I did a bit of lecturing at Glasgow University, mm-hmm. and at, what's it called? One of the colleges in Glasgow.
Forgive Still my college. Ignorance. If you did a degree in chemistry, is nuclear physics related to chemistry?
Very much so. Actually, the peaceful nuclear production, mm-hmm. the uranium is put in and it gives you the power. It then gets used up. It gets diluted, actually. It has to be taken out. After that, it's a huge chemical process. Very much involved. You have to dissolve the rods, you have to precipitate the things that don't belong in there, and so on and so on. It's being now done at Whitehaven, near Whitehaven.
How long, now I know why you're in Vancouver, how long were you there? Because you must have come back from Vancouver.
Oh yes, when we got a bit older, my mother-in-law was getting a little bit odd. My sister-in-law lost her husband and other kind of things.
And that brought you back here?
That brought us back here.
Also to teach nuclear physics?
No, bad. Don't forget, by the time I got my degree, I was already in my late 70s. So,
you were getting older.
So I just finished off teaching for a few years in a school and retired.
Excellent. Well, you certainly had lots of adventures. Once you were here in Scotland, did you mix with former Polish people or Jewish
people?
No,
by the time I came back from Vancouver, the Polish community diluted itself, and I actually lost contact with them. Nor did I have much contact with the Jewish community. My wife knew quite a number of Jewish people, but I didn't. So she actually worked for a while in jewelry for several Jewish people, manageress. People called Yaffe, did you know them?
I think we know some people in Glasgow now who are called Yaffe, yes.
Yeah, well, one of the Yaffes, her husband was called Coates. He's a Coates, and he had a jewelers. My wife was his manageress. And before that, there was also a family called the Crabs. They had jeweler's shop. And actually also the Pattersons, whose notice are still operating. My wife worked for them also.
And what did something bring you back more into the Jewish community? Because I know you attend AGR meetings.
My dentist is
Norton.
Norton Grossman. Mm. And one day he said to me, why don't you do some voluntary work? My wife died. Why don't you? So, okay, so then East Renfrewshire phoned me and said, are you Jewish? I said, yes. Well, there's a synagogue in so-and-so, and they require some assistance in the office. So I went up, and that's how I sort of got...
That was at the Reform... Was that the Reform synagogue?
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh, so it's a Reform... Yeah. And that's how you met the Ensigns.
We always ask if you feel a sense of identity with where you came from or where you've arrived. But you've had so many places in between. Yeah. Is it a hard question?
Yeah, it is. I retain a measure of, shall we say, of sympathy for Poland, although it no longer deserves it. But I do retain it. To what extent I feel British? I felt that once I have become a British citizen, when I was in Canada, there was a degree of pressure to become a Canadian citizen. I didn't. I didn't bother. So I don't know if I feel much. I am interested in what happens in the country, but whether I'm committed to it is a different story. It's difficult to say. Mm-hmm. For instance, I certainly wouldn't vote S&P. So am I committed to Scotland? I don't know.
One of the very interesting things as well, which I think happened, Moniek, was the fact of your family being traced.
Yes.
So,
well, this was... I didn't know what happened to my family. Mm-hmm. And I actually tried to keep a low profile on the basis that if any of my family survived, I was hoping that the Soviet Union would not be aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
But they were aware of it.
So you mean be aware of the fact you were no longer in Poland?
Not only were they aware that I was no longer in Russia, but they were fully aware it was in the Polish forces. They had an extremely efficient means of finding out how on earth a country in which the majority of the population are constantly hungry, how they could devote that amount of energy and effort to keep tabs on insignificant people who have at one time been in their country. They actually consider the act of my moving out of the Soviet Union as treachery.
It's treachery, even though you're actually Polish in the
first place. Yeah. They perceived it as treachery.
And treachery, would that be punishable by death, by any chance?
For someone of my lack of importance, probably by prison camp. People who served 10-year sentences frequently got another 10-year tacked on when it was time to be released.
Mm. So you kept a low profile, but you knew what happened to your brother.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, right.
I, in fact, didn't know that he was alive. I only found out that he and his family lived in the Soviet Union when I got that, when I met that young man from the Jewish gen.
From Michael Tobias?
Yeah.
Gosh.
So it's Michael Tobias.
Mm-hmm. So that's I actually
met him, some meeting in the synagogue, he met me there. I said, well, I could give you some interesting extra information. So I told him about myself. Extra information. He came back with a huge sheet giving my family tree, which I incidentally sort of knew, but this was much more up-to-date information.
Once you found out about your brother, did you find out, I think you were going to tell us, that he was in trouble because of the fact that you had left?
He was in trouble partly because I have left the Soviet Union. This is what it meant, is that he was not allowed to work in any city of more than 300,000 of a population. That was the kind of ruling. So instead of being a professor in Minsk, they appointed him to be headmaster of a school of music, which was probably not his métier at all.
And am I right that your family thought you had died?
Yes, why is he thought I should have been killed at Monte Cassino? That nonsense. So when they found out, it was...
Must have been so remarkable, so many years later.
Yes.
And was your brother still alive at that time?
No, my brother died in the 60s.
So it was his children?
Yeah. People die much more quickly in the Soviet Union now. People don't live to old age. A variety of reasons. Those who do well die early because A, too much drink, and B, not good enough food. Other people just die because of miserable conditions. And alcoholism is extremely widespread in the Soviet Union. This doesn't mean that my brother wasn't, but probably just depression didn't help him very much.
We usually end by asking people a very general question on reflections over a whole lifetime. What would you say, looking back, if you can tell us, were the high points in your life, and of course the low points?
Well, the high point obviously was getting my education. That to me was a high point. Low point, quite a number. Extreme low point when I lost my wife and I was left here on my own.
Mm. Of course.
We had no family, incidentally.
You talk about, you do have a nephew. Is that on your side or is that your
my wife's
side?
Yeah.